This episode is sponsored by Code Health. Code connects healthcare providers to the largest community of medical coding professionals in the country, with over 4,600 domestic certified coders. As a single stop for all coding needs, Code's on-demand model has solved for daily staffing challenges and coding inefficiencies by allowing providers to access the right coder at the right time while gaining insights to better manage their coding operations. To learn more about Code, visit codehealth.com, that's K-O-D-E-health.com, or email Code directly at partnerships@codehealth.com. Doing right by the patient with charity care screening, today on HFMA's Voices in Healthcare Finance podcast. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Erica Grotto, and I've got a little scoop today. The May issue of HFM Magazine focuses on a health system that designed a process to identify patients who qualify for charity care. That story by HFMA senior editor Nick Hutt will be out soon at hfma.org and maybe your mailbox. But given all the conversation around charity care and financial assistance in the media, this week I have HFMA Policy Director Sean Stack talking about how and why hospitals should review their charity care processes. But first, you're going to hear from both Nick and Sean about the latest in healthcare finance news.
All right, we are fired up to talk about the Inpatient Prospective Payment System proposed rule for 2025. That's FY25 specifically. But first, I feel like we're almost obligated to touch on the Change Healthcare situation, maybe in each episode until it gets resolved. And just in the last 24 hours, we heard that a ransomware group reportedly has started leaking protected health information on the dark web. Now, this is not the Black Cat group that is said to have gotten a $22 million ransom payout. I believe the group is called Ransom Hub. And again, according to reports, it was affiliated with Black Cat, helped with the attack, didn't get the payout. They thought they were from Black Cat. So now they're trying to get a payment of their own. And they have all or some of the PHI from the attack, and it's starting to leak out now. And so this is fallout that needs to be monitored. Sean, anything to mention about that or just the whole restoration effort that's ongoing for providers and payers?
I think there as you know, as well as the ongoing ransomware attack issues and releases of PHI that we're hearing now again, I think hospitals are still working very diligently with payers as they come back up online with Change Healthcare and their functionality is brought back. Some folks are experiencing provider enrollment issues, claims processing issues still. We're beginning to, of course, Nick, to hear about those duplication denials that I was fearing for the last couple of weeks. So just a lot of cleanup and administrative lift still going on around bringing all those payers and providers back up online since the hack. So I think this is going to be going on for several weeks, maybe a couple months still.
Yeah. So in general, the restoration effort is proceeding, but slowly. So moving on to the IPPS proposed rule, it's a 1,900-page rule, at least the pre-publication draft that they sent out. Overall, it seems like there was a little bit for hospitals to like and plenty for them to recoil at, including the payment update, which is projected at 2.6%. Again, this is only the proposed rule. These things have a way of ticking up by maybe a half of a percentage point, possibly more, by the time of the final rule due to changes in the market basket inputs. But even if that happens, the update would be just a fraction of the inflationary trends that hospitals have been dealing with. Sean, your take.
You know, a very low market basket increase this year at 2.6%, coming in at 1.8% for those hospitals not submitting quality data. And then, of course, a decrease of 0.4% for those hospitals that are not meaningful users of electronic health records and the quality data. So pretty big impacts here. And I agree, Nick, given the inflation, cost of healthcare, cost of drugs and supplies, this is a pretty low market basket increase for hospitals for 2025. Also keep in mind that, you know, as expected for rate setting purposes, CMS is proposing to use the fiscal year 2023 MedPAR claims data and the fiscal year 2022 cost report data. So no surprises there of the data they'll be using to set these for rate setting purposes. But yeah, I'm anticipating a lot of pushback on this market basket increase for 2025.
One thing, and I feel like we say this every year, but the permutations of the wage index and the various accompanying adjustments mean substantial variation in the actual payment update for a specific hospital, depending on what region of the country and what market it's in. So it's definitely worth checking out the table they published in the rule that shows the impact of different adjustments on the overall update. What else? The unemployment compensation number is at least a welcome turnaround from the FY24 rule when it dropped by about $950 million. This time it's projected to increase by about $568 million. But anything else strike you in terms of the payment update?
The low wage index hospital policy for fiscal year 2025. I mean, concerns there. Lots of data analysis that'll be, you know, data crunching that's going to be going on over the next month, 2 months to look at these OMB impacts. You know, OMB always issues a major revision every 10 years based on, you know, the results of their decennial census. As such, that was released in bulletin number, I think it was 23-01, if I remember right, I didn't write that down. Based on that current census, the agency proposes to revise the hospital labor market areas. So we've been seeing a lot of shifts in wage index over the last couple of years. This is just another shift that I think hospitals are going to have to really crunch the numbers on and make sure that they're ready for those impacts and budgeting appropriately. You know, just a little bit more of fluctuation there, Nick. I think that'll have the hair on the back of everyone's necks raised, to be honest with you.
Yeah, appreciate your calling our attention to that. So definitely something to watch for. So I'm sure we're short on time, but the rule also includes a mandatory bundled payment model covering 5 clinical episode types. It would be mandatory starting in 2026 for all hospitals in certain markets that have yet to be determined. Sean, what should people know about this going forward over the next couple of years before the start date?
This is definitely the news flash, I think, that came out of the proposed IPPS rule this year. I think this is probably the most talked about topic so far, Nick, you know, 2 weeks in, I guess. Yeah, those 5 surgical episode categories, coronary artery bypass, grafts, CABGs, lower extremity joint replacements, major bowel procedures, surgical hip femur fracture treatment, and then spinal fusion are the 5 surgical episode categories that CMS is rolling out under that mandatory team model for 5 years. I think that begins January 1st, 2026, and ends December 31st, 2030. I'll be talking with my colleagues at AHA and, you know, at hospital associations and hospitals across the nation on this, getting their feedback. This is a big move on CMMI's part. So definitely something that we're going to be watching and talking about intensively over the next couple of months as we prepare our comments.
No doubt. And one more thing worth being aware of in the rule, I think, is the data reporting requirements for respiratory diseases. The pandemic-based requirements are wrapping up this very month, but a subset of those would have to be reported starting in October and going forward on at least indefinitely, if not on a permanent basis. So worth checking out those requirements.
Yeah, my read on that, Nick, was those were permanent so far. That's the proposal of those reporting metrics. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it seems like CMS was going for. So again, this is all proposed for the time being. Anything else jump out at you, Sean? Will HFMA be sharing comments or feedback with CMS, do you think?
When? Probably about a week before the deadline. So we'll be working on those diligently with our partners and our hospitals to get those organized and submitted.
All right. And for anyone wanting to submit your own comments on that rule, you have until June 10th. Many thanks, everybody.
We'll be back in a moment.
This is Sean Stack, HFMA's Director of Perspectives and Analysis, and I'm excited to tell you about our new bi-monthly webinar series designed specifically for hospital executives. HFMA will provide timely updates on the latest national healthcare reimbursement and revenue cycle regulations, policies, and trends.
This series will equip you with the knowledge and insights you need to navigate the complex world of your healthcare business office. You can register now at hfma.org under webinars.
The charity care processes adopted by healthcare providers have attracted criticism in media stories focusing on the high cost of care. If you follow our blog and podcast series, Healthcare Blame Game, you're well aware of these stories and the impact they have. But according to my guest today, revisiting charity care policies and processes could be valuable when assessing patient financial communications. You know HFMA Policy Director Sean Stack from the Beyond the News segment of this podcast. But recently, I was able to sit down with him to talk about what hospitals can do to do right by the patient. Charity care has come under scrutiny in the media, with the prevailing narrative being that hospitals do not provide enough of it. Why do you think that narrative exists?
I think, first of all, no one can define what enough of it is, right? And I know that hospitals are offering charity care and financial assistance and reliable payment plans to anyone who qualifies for them when the patient agrees to have that conversation with the provider. I think many times what the struggle there is, Erica, is really getting that patient to the table where they trust the provider or the hospital enough to have those financial assistance discussions or those qualifying conversations for charity care. It's a trust relationship there that the hospital really has to build with the patient.
The cover story for the May issue of HFM is about a health system that designed a process to catch more patients who qualify for charity care. How would you recommend that hospitals and health systems start the conversations with patients to ensure that those who qualify for any type of assistance receive that assistance?
What you're talking about is a presumptive charity eligibility process, which actually is growing in popularity across, you know, the healthcare market with hospitals and providers, you know, in the last couple of years. And a lot of that goes in hand with the technology that's now offered to be able to pre-qualify these patients very early on by credit checks, by income verifications that folks can now obtain through TransUnion and different mechanisms to qualify these patients with great certainty that they should be eligible for a discount or for full-blown charity assistance. So that is helping hospitals a great deal. You're right. Hospitals never want to send a patient, and I do mean this, never want to send a patient to collections that can qualify for charity. It's just making that connection with that patient. And honestly, the further upstream a hospital does that, the more captivated audience they have to screen them for charity eligibility and not only get that patient in for that service that they need, but also make sure that that patient feels comfortable coming back for the follow-up care they need to know that that care is also going to be hopefully taken care of. So it's not just that one service. Many of these services have follow-up care that patients need to seek. That's what a hospital's focusing on, is making sure that full continuum of care is provided to that hospital. And to give you an indication on how nuanced some of this outreach is, Erica, is I just spoke to a business partner that works very closely with HFMA and is doing a health equity study with us right now that had designed a program where they actually provide folks to hospitals to screen patients in person for charity care and financial assistance at the hospitals. And what their training many times encompasses is, you know, casual dress, speak in patient terms that are easily understandable, and making that patient relate to you so they're comfortable talking to you. Well, what this business partner found out, which this is crazy to me, and I would have made the same mistake, is they have an entire texting outreach program for charity care. So if a patient comes into a hospital and they go home, they might send a text message out and say, hey, please fill out this online screening application. You may be eligible for charity care. What they found was, when different from the in-person, very personal conversation, you know, very relatable conversation, when you send text to a patient, if you present that text content in an informal setting,
patients ignore it because they think it's a scam. If it's not formal, looking like it came from a hospital entity, that they don't engage. So they had to roll that back and send out a more formal digital communication to the patient so they could trust it. So we are learning through this outreach on what works for different populations of the population, for different patients that we serve in different communities. But that's something that hospitals are really working toward, you know, to collect charity care applications so we can process them very timely.
Yeah, that's a really interesting finding.
It was fascinating to me, right?
Yeah. So you talked a bit about patient comfort, making patients feel comfortable, getting the care they need, coming back to get the follow-up care they need. You also talked about that in a recent interview with Rose Scott on NPR in Atlanta. In that interview, you talked about kind of a culture shift that has occurred in healthcare, where it used to be that providers would not discuss payment with patients, and they would make a point of not discussing payment with patients because they were afraid that patients would get scared about the cost and wouldn't get the care they need. But the switch has kind of flipped where the industry best practice is to be proactive about these discussions. Why do you think that shift has occurred or is occurring?
I mean, several facets. I mean, yes, I'm 52 years old now, going on 53, unfortunately, or I guess fortunately, right? Beats alternative. And when I got into healthcare in my early 20s, the norm was that the patients, doctors did not look at insurance coverage. They saw a patient for who a patient was and what their presenting diagnosis was or what their issue was, and let the office staff worry about billing and about insurance coverage. And that was the norm then, because we should treat all patients equal as healthcare providers, regardless of their ability to pay or regardless of their insurance. Well, now that healthcare costs have increased enormously over the past several decades, and not just because hospitals are raising prices, but because healthcare has gotten so much better and technology that is providing these better healthcare resources has gotten so much more expensive, you know, costs have risen. And high deductible plans are on the rise. You know, a bronze exchange plan, annual out-of-pocket, is right around $9,000. Who can afford $9,000 a year in medical bills every year, right? So there's been a lot of shifting influences that have made healthcare providers now really assess, Peggy Sue is coming in for this procedure. This is her insurance. She's on an exchange plan with a high out-of-pocket deductible. We need to talk to Peggy Sue about, can she afford paying for that deductible? Or do we need to try to screen her for charity care or assistance or a payment plan before she comes in so she's not surprised by that coinsurance or deductible that she's going to be due based on the plan that she's under, and then she doesn't come back in for the follow-up care because she doesn't want to rack up more bills. So we've just, based on the cost of healthcare and also the changes in the insured population with these different types of plans that are a lot more higher out-of-pocket cost to patients, we've had to shift our focus.
One thing that comes up in some of the stories we read on this topic is that patients are avoiding needed care because of the cost. And with mechanisms like good faith estimates and transparency tools, we're better able to know that cost sometimes, but not all the time. So I wonder how often patients are putting off care, not because it will cost a lot, but because they think it will cost a lot. What do you think about this?
It really creates a large impact on delayed care and care that the patients don't seek because of fear. It really, the word there is fear. If I had a 20-year-old car and I was told consistently by the media that if I go to a new car dealership or a used car dealership, I'm going to be fully taken advantage of and I'm going to be bankrupt if I try to get another car and don't get my 20-year-old car fixed, I'm probably going to limp along as long as I can on that 20-year-old car until it breaks down. Well, that's the same thing with healthcare. If you're constantly told that if you go in for maintenance or you go in for preventative care or some procedure that is not necessarily life-threatening right now, but could be life-threatening or cause a car to break down on the interstate and maybe you get rear-ended and critically injured, if you don't get that care, it is eventually going to become more acute or more critical. It's the same thing. That fear mentality that hospitals don't want to work with you is not the case. We want you to get preventative care. We want you to get items addressed as they come up, and we will work with you if you're at all eligible for any type of charity care or financial assistance or payment plans. We will be more than happy to work with you because we want to keep you healthier and keep you out of those emergency room for those acute care settings. I think the thing to keep in mind with patients is, and with healthcare in general, and you know, Rick Gundling has often references this when he's talking about healthcare pricing and healthcare collections and payment for healthcare, is healthcare is very different than any other consumable or product that's offered to the public. It is emotional. You're seeking healthcare because you don't feel good or something's wrong with you physically or mentally. And it's an emotional process. And that's the key, is when you're in an emotional process, like seeking healthcare services, whether you're stressed out because of your diagnosis or the issue that you're having, or you're just nervous about the cost or even about going to see a doctor. Not everyone loves their doctor. Hopefully that's gotten better because bedside manners are definitely a lot better than they used to be. But it's an emotional process. So you're right, Erica. When you're thinking about the finances, you're stressed already and you're having an emotional reaction to the needs that you are trying to get addressed. So it compounds your rational thinking. And that's when you look at the prices and you don't think you want to go an extra step and ask the hospital for assistance for charity care or to get screened and talk about your personal finances. It's just an added layer of stress that you don't want to go into at the moment. So it's completely understandable that charity care assistance, screening assistance needs to move either pre-scheduling before the patient comes in for it, or down the road, hopefully not, but hopefully further up in the process. But sometimes for some patients, it is better to screen them for charity care assistance after the incident has been addressed and they've sought the medical care they need, such as in acute care settings. It has to be done afterwards. And there's a reason for that. It really is an emotional purchase, and we need to be cognizant of that as healthcare providers.
Well, Sean, it's been delightful having you on the podcast. You're on every episode, but I usually don't get to be the one to talk to you. So, Sean Stack, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Erica. Great conversation.
Voices in Healthcare Finance is a production of the Healthcare Financial Management Association and written and hosted by me, Erica Grotto. Additional reporting is by Nick Hutt, Sean Stack, and the HFMA editorial staff. Sound editing is by Linda Chandler. Brad Dennison is the director of content. Our president and CEO is Ann Jordan. Did you just swear at me?